Hey listeners, this is Travis Book, bassist and singer in the bluegrass band The Infamous String Dusters. I started the Travis Book Happy Hour to try to get to the root of what makes my contemporaries tick, what inspires and motivates them, and why they make music. It's an hour where we get to play together, talk about life, and do it all in front of a live studio audience. If you haven't listened yet, maybe check out some of my highlights, including Sierra Hull, Bepe Gambetta, Tim O'Brien, and Lindsay Liu. You can find every episode of the Travis Book Happy Hour on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. Do you like that inflection?
I don't, and I feel like you have called into question everything that I thought was true about our show. Like, are they folk musicians? Is it honest? Is it called Basic Folk? Just give me something I can count on.
Oh, okay. How about this? Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I'm your host, Cindy Howes, with my delightful co-host, Lizzie No.
Thank you for returning to normal.
No problem. I'm always here for you. I'm all about being normal. You know me.
Normal as it gets. You know what they call her, old Normie Town.
Today on the podcast, we have Brent Cobb. Lizzie had the opportunity to speak with Brent, who has a new gospel album out and a crazy story that we'll hear about in just a bit. Basic Folk is a listener-supported podcast. You can make a financial contribution at our website, basicfolk.com. If you give at least $5 a month or $60 for the entire year, you'll have access to our bonus content, which also lives on our website. And it is called Backstage. You can also sign up for our newsletter at our website or follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. You can leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends.
I want to encourage people to tell their enemies about the podcast. And here's why. Because if people are only telling their friends, we're probably only going to get one type of personality, like maybe the nice people, right? But then if you tell your enemies, then we're actually branching out into the community of like bad people, which is a demographic I feel like we haven't tried to reach for. You know what I'm
Interesting.
Saying?
Interesting.
Like, why limit ourselves to people that we and our audience respect? Like, why not reach out to everyone, including the losers, the bullies, the terrible bosses?
I draw the line at white supremacists and Nazis.
I think I am comfortable saying on record that I, too, draw the line at white supremacists and Nazis. In case anyone didn't hear us the first time, Cindy Howes, Lizzie No, Basic Folk, and all of our affiliates draw the line at white supremacists and Nazis.
Speaking of affiliates, we have a really great piece of information that has already been shared, but this is the first time Lizzie and I are talking together on a podcast about this news, is that Basic Folk has officially joined the Bluegrass Situations podcast network. Yay!
My heart is aflutter, Cindy. The Bluegrass Situation people are so cool. We are like in with the cool crowd. This is a big step for us, and I'm very excited for our new partnership.
Yeah, lots of great things to come, but thanks to the Bluegrass Situation team for being so welcoming and so lovely. I feel like I have like 100 spreadsheets and Google Docs that I've thrown at them and they're like, we love it.
I say keep the spreadsheets coming. I think that's one of your love languages, if I'm not wrong.
Google Docs. Yes. We also have a podcast recommendation for you if you like folk music, which I think you do because you're listening to us. This podcast is presented by Folk Alley. It is called Why We Write, and it is hosted by the one and only Kim Rule, who is the former editor-in-chief at No Depression Magazine. She's had a long history of writing and being a rad person, and she has talked to people like Mary Gaucher, Mark Arely, Sonny War, Roseanne Cash on Why We Write, and really digging into the craft of writing, Kim is also a former singer-songwriter. I mean, she still might write songs, but she doesn't release them. So she comes at this from a scholarly perspective. And she's just like such a fabulous person. We're going to share an episode in our feed in just a couple of weeks, but you'll hear us talking about it before the podcast starts. It's called Why We Write, and you can find it anywhere you get podcasts or at folkalley.com. Another thing is that Lizzie Noh is going to be on one of our favorite podcasts called You Are Good, which is a feelings podcast about movies. So it's Sarah Marshall and Alex Steed and Carolyn Kendrick. Carolyn has been on Basic Folk in the past. They talk about movies and break it down from like an emotional perspective. And Lizzie gets to pick the movie that she's going to talk about.
Can I tell them what I picked? It's so good.
Yes, please.
Guys, I'm talking about A Little Princess. I cannot emphasize enough how important this movie was to me as a child, how quickly I can recall the theme song, like how strange of a movie it is for kids. The whole thing is absolutely batshit, and I can't wait to talk about it with You Are Good.
I watched it within the last couple of years with my fiance, Elizabeth, and I was like crying my eyes out the whole time. And she was like, dry as a bone, like looking at me like, what is your problem? And I'm like, you don't understand. This is the trilogy of Warner Brothers.
Yes.
Children's stories come to life.
The Secret Garden.
And Black Beauty.
Black Beauty. Oh my gosh, I forgot about Black Beauty. I mean, I live it every day, but I forgot about the film adaptation.
What book are you reading?
Oh, this is tied into my vacation as well, because when everybody went skiing, I opted to sit in the ski lodge reading bell hooks all day, and then like sort of just like randomly shouting things about the patriarchy. She has this amazing book that I'm sure a lot of our listeners know and love, All About Love. Like right from the introduction, it blew me away. She was like, this is a topic that needs to be talked about because culturally, we've decided that like love and emotions are the realm of women. And yet when it comes to like most of the popular books about love and relationships, a lot of them are written by men, and we don't usually take women's opinions as seriously because we assume like, oh, that's just like a fluffy, feminine, you know, silly, embarrassing, this and that. I started to really think about that, like how our views on relationships and feelings are often tainted by misogyny. And I think it can seep into how we think about music, how we think about art, you know, the way we take men's art more seriously by default. Mm-hmm. And it really just made me want to like have a deeper engagement with women's ideas about love and women's ideas about emotions and feelings about loss and this and that. So it's been a really, really enlightening and beautiful and tough read.
I hope you bring this into your episode of You Are Good, because
you know I will.
They're going to love it.
You know I will.
So that episode could be out now or it could be out in the near future, but we will let you know. We're recording this on Ash Wednesday. It is the beginning of the Lenten season.
What are you giving up, Cindy?
That's what I would like to speak about, Lizzie. So I am addicted to my my smartphone. What I'm going to do is try not to use my phone as much. Like, I don't know if I officially want to say like, okay, I'll only look at my phone between the hours of 10 and 6, you know, workday. Mm-hmm. I need to have some kind of device to play music on and podcasts. So what I did is I fired up my old iPod. Did you just hear that?
Wow, that click. That click.
And I put a bunch of WAV files on here because every month I make a playlist of new songs that I love. And so I decided to take that playlist, make it on Tidal, but also like download the songs as WAV files and then put them onto the iPod.
Wait, are you able to do that through Tidal?
No, I had to find them in other places like Bandcamp and such.
Got it. Okay.
So far, it's working out pretty good. I have 24 songs on here so far. I brought it to my workout session and plugged it in. Like, I had to find my little auxiliary cord and plug it into their speaker, their Bluetooth speaker. And, you know, we're doing our workout, and Donnie, who's my trainer, they were like, this sounds like really good. And it made me realize it's because they're WAV files, and that's like the highest quality digital download you can get.
Yeah, I live for a WAV file.
So now I need to figure out if I can put podcasts on it. I need to like purchase a Garmin GPS and then figure out two-factor authentication.
Oh my God. If the listeners could see the look I'm giving Cindy right now, it's a mix of like, ooh, girl, and ooh, girl. You know, like I'm proud of you, and I cannot imagine going through that much trouble to get music nowadays when we've gotten so used to getting things so quickly and conveniently. And I'm proud of you for taking these steps as ways to like declutter and refocus your brain.
It's funny because it's actually cluttering my actual life files and...
Yeah, you can clutter your devices as a way to declutter your mind.
Yeah, totally.
Also, let me just say that I am on tour. Please go to lizzynomusic.com/tour and please find out if I'm coming and playing in your city, because I would love to sing to you personally, dear listener.
Also, you'd have the opportunity to see that Lizzie No is taller in person.
I never thought of myself as tall because my sister is very tall, taller than I. So I thought of myself as the small one. And you know what that gets me thinking about is family. You know who loves their family and has a really deep and creative and unique relationship with their family? Can you guess, Cindy? It rhymes with bent knob.
Is it Brent Cobb?
It sure is. You're the big winner.
That sounds like a good whiskey.
Maybe it is. We should pitch him on that idea, like a celebrity whiskey brand, Brent Cobb's Bent Knob. Okay. Brent Cobb. Let me say he was a dream guest because he was so game to talk about such a variety of topics, and he's such an interesting guy. Really like dyed in the wool Southern gospel and country artist. He kind of had this interesting path into the music industry, which is that his cousin is the producer extraordinaire Dave Cobb, and they met as adults. Like, they didn't have a relationship growing up. By the time they met, Dave was already this big-time producer. And so Brent passed him his demo CD, and they have worked together, and they've been growing that artist-producer relationship ever since.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a very cool partnership, and I think something that's interesting to me as someone who, like, you know, nowadays reads a lot of artist bios and is interviewing more and more people, a lot of male artists, I feel like, love to don the like multi-hyphenate cap. And I don't want to speak for Brent, but he was really clear about saying like, Dave is the producer, you know, I'm a singer-songwriter. And I think that there's this interesting dynamic where often it's like we think of like the producer and artist is often this like male-female dynamic where there's like this mm-hmm. woman artist and she's sort of a muse. But I kind of see Brent that way. Like, he has the voice of an angel. He's so creative. He's so cool. He has this like very gentle presence. And so I feel like he's able to transcend a lot of those bro-y country stereotypes. So that's just my personal armchair psychology analysis of Brent. But back to his real story. He has released like hit album after hit album while also writing for some huge mainstream country stars like Luke Bryan, which was very fun to talk about. He was nominated for a Grammy for his album Shine on Rainy Day. And his recent album is kind of a pivot musically, but I think really makes sense in terms of the journey that he's on as an artist. Brent was in a really serious car crash with his young son in the back of the car. He kind of came to lying on the ground, you know.
Wow.
Got himself over to the car to check on his baby, and he was like happy as a clam, you know, chilling in the car seat. And it made Brent want to revisit his childhood roots growing up in the church, you know, being with family in the church pew, all singing together, the participatory community aspect of music. So he has released this unbelievably good gospel album, and now Turn to Page, which is a very sweet title. And we talked about what it was like to approach these like time-honored songs and write a new original gospel song with his wife, Lane Cobb. It's a really moving song based on that, you know, life or death experience that he had. And we talked about a million things, you know, touring, recording process, obviously his relationship with his producer and friend and cousin, Dave Cobb, and how he sees himself in terms of sort of an ambassador or an interpreter of Southern gospel culture and everything that that means to him. So he's a fascinating guy. We've already been in correspondence because we talked about some poetry during our interview, and I just had to follow up with him about that. So I think he's such a cool artist, and his new album is super inspiring, and my mom approves it. It is mom approved.
That's right.
I played it for her, and she was like, let me write down this artist, because the hymns are, I mean, there's just something so deep for me about these hymns and the way that he puts this gentle Willie Nelson kind of spin on them. So that's my many thoughts about Brent Cobb.
Our target demographic is moms.
Yeah.
Moms. Okay, let's take a listen to a song from Brent's new album. This is Just a Closer Walk with Thee, and then we'll get to our conversation with Brent Cobb and Lizzie Noh on Basic Folk.
Just a closer walk with thee. Granted, Jesus is my plea. Daily walking close to thee. Let it be, dear Lord, let it be.
Could not be more thrilled to be here with the fabulous songwriter and performer Brent Cobb.
Hello.
So let's just get right into it. No chit chat. I want to set the scene as far as your upbringing and the church community that you grew up in. What was your engagement with spirituality as a kid? Like, was faith something that you always held in yourself, or was it more a thing that your family kind of brought you along?
For sure, you know, Southern Baptist here from South Georgia, mm-hmm. So it was very much family, you know, and most of my church is a very, very small little country church, and a lot of the congregation was my own family, and so, yeah, we'd just sing all these gospel songs, and my aunt played the piano in the corner, and my granddaddy led the singing, and then we'd just go eat a bunch of fried chicken and stuff, so it was, you know, it was very much family, Sunday in the South vibes.
Yeah.
Going to church.
So not so much that fear and trembling all alone spirituality, but more the community side of things was what like really drew you in.
Totally, very much. That's absolutely what it was.
And what do you think that type of upbringing did to your understanding of relationships?
It makes me believe in a community, and it makes me, you know, feel like if you fall, you have someone to fall back on, or vice versa. You know, you help each other out, and you try to uplift each other, and you enjoy lunch together. which is the main reason you go to church there. For it seems like for us was to just starve yourself for about an hour, and so you want to go eat a lot of food after the service as a family.
Yeah, that reminds me of my childhood. My grandparents are from North and South Carolina, and I sat through a lot of long prayers. Mm-hmm. I appreciated it, Grandma, but I really was thinking about pie.
Yeah, your stomach's just growling the whole time, and the preacher is just like those like going 10 minutes over noon, you know, and everybody's
always.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that's like the real, that's like how I relate to Jesus in the desert, like when you're just like waiting for it to be and now everyone go eat moment.
Yes.
So it sounds like you grew up in a really like participatory musical environment as well. So did it ever occur to you that music would be your job?
I didn't view it as a job. I didn't even consider that you could get paid for it. And my dad played on the weekends as a secondary source of income, but I didn't, mm-hmm. so I knew you could do it that way, but I didn't think you could do it full time. You know, I didn't know that you could keep your lights on with it.
Yeah. Who were some of the like popular music people that you looked up to growing up?
Growing up, I don't know. My dad was the first one. I loved Willie Nelson as a kid, and mm-hmm. Dolly Parton has always just brought joy to my life. You know, mm-hmm. Hank Williams Sr., all of the real traditional classic. Matter of fact, at my church in Sunday school, I was probably 3 or 4. I can remember this pretty vividly. The Sunday school teacher asked all of us in the class to get up and perform a song of our choice. And so I stood up on the table and I sang, "There's a Tear in My Beer, 'Cause I'm Crying for You, Dear," by Hank Williams Sr. in Sunday school. And so it's always been sort of one and the same, honky tonk and Sunday school.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I love it. I think the best things in life combine the sacred and the profane.
That's what
it's all one thing.
Isn't that life? That's just life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think there's you kind of started out as a songwriter before stepping out as an artist. Do you think there's an alternate universe in which Brent Cobb is just like a lifelong music row songwriter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes I wish that was this timeline. I'm just, touring has never been my favorite thing, but for me it's just been necessary, and to put out my own albums. One of the questions everybody asks you when you come to Music Row is, well, are you an artist or are you a songwriter? And I'm like, well, I sing them, I write them, I don't know, I guess I'm both. And for whatever reason, for me, I've had several cuts by the radio commercial side of things and by other artists. But I've never had a big hit, but those songs have always been written as though I would put them on my own album as well. And I can't write the other way. I can't write for the commercial radio market. It never works. And it's not what any of those artists or people want to hear. So maybe there is an alternate universe where I'm just this massive hit songwriter, but that's not the timeline I'm in.
I think I have so much respect for people who are able to sit down in a room with other professional writers and like write for somebody else's voice. 'Cause I think that takes a type of ability to like step out of your own experience that I just don't have. And I think you are really also a strong songwriter in the sense that you can tell that you are writing from your own experiences.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of like you're one or the other. I'm sure there's people that can do both, but it's tough.
Yeah, I respect it as well. I am terrible at it. Every time I have, when my daughter was born in 2014, I'd stop touring and just wrote and did Music Row every day. And during those years, I was trying really hard to do that, and I just can't do it. And just the worst songs I've ever written, ever. And I can't, and I don't have any luck with it anyway. So, yeah, I don't know. It's definitely its own craft that I didn't get.
What does Nashville do for you creatively? Like, I know this recent record is really like a coming home record, but there are other things about Nashville that you find inspiring?
Always still walking through the alleys on Music Row, or just really all of, like, you know the song by Kris Kristofferson, To Beat the Devil? All right, so, yeah. You know, it was wintertime.
I love Kristofferson.
I did, too. It was wintertime in Nashville down on Music City Row, and I was looking for a place to get my guitar out of the cold, you know. Whatever. It's just all of that whole description of being a broke songwriter. And every time I go down there to write a song, or I have a little apartment that I split with some other songwriter buddies, that and it's right there off Music Row. And for when I come to town, and just being there is just like, God, the history of it all is all inspiring to me. You know, it very much is easy to sit up there late night on Music Row at a little pub house and go, who else did this? All of my heroes, you know, it inspires me very much.
That reminds me of like what I've heard from people that work in the airline industry, of like having a shared apartment for when you're in town.
Right.
I mean, you are married with a family. Is it weird to like kind of go back into those bachelor times of like having roommates?
Well, we're not usually there at the same time, first of all.
Okay.
So, because we all tour. And so it's not really, but yeah, I mean, I feel guilty about it sometimes because, and I'm not, like last night I went out and played a show with my buddy Aaron Ratier, and Hayes Carl was there, and Adam Hood, and you know, we played at the original basement, which was, it felt like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, me and Hood, who is one of the people I split this apartment with, we went back to the apartment. We were there at 9:15, you know, and everybody's going out. And I just ordered two pizzas and you know, went to sleep at like 10. But I do feel guilty that my wife, you know, she's got the kids, and my daughter's 7, so she's in school. And so it'd be different if we were, you know, if my kids could all, if Lila didn't have to be at school and they could just all be up here at the same time, it'd be great.
Oh, man. Do you dream of a world where, like, your kids could do school remotely and they could, like, travel with you more?
I do, but then, I mean, you want your kids to go be around other kids. I do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, which we did do remote school there for a while, but I wasn't touring because there was a global pandemic.
Yeah.
But
horrible, horrible times.
Oh, well, yeah, I know. I hate to even say it with a smile, but what else can we do? You know what I mean? We're a couple of the lucky ones who get to still work, and we have our health for the most part. And but yeah, I do think about, you know, I would love to get to the level of, and maybe this sounds crazy, but if I could have just two buses one bus would be great. But if I could have two buses, you know, and one of the buses for all of us and the band and the crew, but then the other bus is for the family, and that's not just my family, just anybody in the band, you can rotate your family coming out every other weekend. Mm-hmm. It'd be fantastic.
Oh, that'd be great. It would be like no cuss words in the family van, and then you bring the rest of the rock and roll in the trailing van.
You leave the family band after the family weekend, and you get into the crew bus, and you just let all the cuss words spew out at one time. You've been holding back. Yeah.
Oh man, I want that for you. I believe in you. I think you can get there.
Thanks.
I would like to talk about the artist-producer relationship. It's fascinating to me. I think that even if, like, as an artist, even if you have a straightforward working relationship with your producer, like 95% of the time, and like you're the most straight-laced people ever, I think at least 5% of that relationship needs to be like completely inexplicable, psychic thoughts between the two of you, just trying to like cast spells and create magic. Yeah. So I am very curious about your dynamic with your cousin, Dave.
Yeah.
I'm sure some of our listeners know Dave Cobb, who you've produced so much great music with. Mm-hmm. If someone were to listen to your music, what are some of his trademarks that are on your records? And how has that relationship influenced you as you've moved from one album to the next?
I'll first say that Dave and I have always had a working relationship, and we didn't know each other growing up. And we didn't meet until music happened. I mean, I was 18. Mm-hmm. And so when we first met, that's how our relationship grew and was a creative relationship. With that said, he produces very much like I write. If I'm writing a song, I know it's a good song. It's very just spur of the moment and very just whatever the muse is, you know, and I kind of know where to fit things and it just falls out of the sky. He's like that. I'll see the end of a song, if it's a good one, before I even start. You know, I just know exactly where it's got to go. And he's that way with a whole record. Like he's very much like he's just a, I don't know what you call it, like an inspired producer. He's but that's how I write too. So there are similarities and his mannerisms. I mean, he probably doesn't even know it, but he reminds me of my grandpa a little bit, just some of the little things that he does. But but I guess because we do come from the same creative cloth in that way, that we are a little psychic because, and I just, you know, you just, even if we weren't cousins, he trusts the guy because he's not a producer that just has a bunch of money and can afford a bunch mm-hmm. of gear. You know, he's can play every instrument in there. And he's a student of great, wonderful records. And he's an engineer first. So I think, you know, the secret behind every great record is a great engineer. And he's all of those.
I agree. I don't think they get enough shine.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm, as an artist, I'm always like truly at their mercy.
For sure.
Because if you grab the wrong mic or you don't have it at precisely the right angle and distance, especially with acoustic instruments.
Yep.
Your record's going to sound like mud.
That's right. And I don't know about any of that stuff. I don't even know, like mm-hmm. the mic that you have right there. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
And I just don't know the gear and stuff. And it's sort of like I remember sitting in algebra in high school and just my brain would, I could not pay attention to what, like it, and that's how, that's how I feel when I try to think about anything other than writing or performing a song. Where Dave will be the whole time, and he's usually playing on everybody's records too, you know, even if it's just an acoustic, but while the whole band is going, he is thinking about all of that stuff at one time mm-hmm. and like listening to each and everything at the same time. I don't understand how you do that. But Dave is, if I'll bring in what I think is a completed song, and it will be lyrically and mostly structurally, but he may would go, what about this little, you know, chord progression for a bridge right here? And it'll be something mm-hmm. that you just have never thought about. Or like on my Shine On Rainy Day album, there are mm-hmm. a lot of very singer-songwriter songs like Solving Problems, you know. And
yes.
most producers, if you took in a song like Solving Problems, which is, you know, very singer-songwriter, there would be no pep in the step. There'd be no groove.
Yeah.
And Dave is really mm-hmm. great at taking a song like that and making it bounce and just make you, you know, sort of like Bad, Bad Leroy Brown or something. You know what I mean? Like
that's the baddest man in the whole damn town. Do you bring in reference tracks or do the two of you just share enough mutual influences that you kind of get like, oh, I want this to sound like, there are times when I'll mm-hmm. go and I'll be like, I want this to sound like a Sheryl Crow song.
Sure.
And then, you know, put together a playlist. Or do the two of you just share enough background?
It's a little bit of
both. That you speak that language.
Some songs, if we can't find, you know how it is, if you can't find exactly whatever that feeling is, then you might go, well, here is a perfect reference for that, you know. And luckily, we both know so much music that it's really easy. If I can't think of a good reference, he'll think of a good reference.
Ugh, that's paradise. Mm-hmm. Speaking of family, on your new gospel album, and now let's turn to Paige, mm-hmm. Your dad and his gospel singing group came into the studio for Old Country Church.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a great track.
Thanks.
How was it working with your dad? I can't imagine having such powerful like family dynamics in the studio. Did you have to like run a tight ship there?
No, they're great. He's had this gospel trio for 4 or 5 years now. They're singing together all the time. They have practice every Wednesday. And then they're usually performing every weekend. And they know, you know, the old country church and the old Rugged Cross. So they pretty much knew what to do. And mm-hmm. yeah, it was great though.
Oh, it turned out beautifully. I mean, thank you. I've also read that your family has a really close history with that hymn, Old Rugged Cross. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's a little bit of a long story and it might get out there, but here we go.
Okay, I don't have anywhere to go.
All right. So when that was my grandpa's favorite gospel song. Just before he got married, he had this dream. And in this dream, he is at a funeral and he walks up to the casket and it's him in the casket. And so he wakes up and he tells his mother about this dream that he had. And she says, well, that means someone close to you is going to pass away soon. And the week of his wedding, she passed away. And when she passed away, all of him and his siblings, they all woke up at the same time of the night in different houses, you know, singing the Old Rugged Cross, which was her favorite gospel song. And so neither of them knew that until the next day. They said, yeah, when they found out their mom died, they said, I woke up singing the Old Rugged Cross last night. And they said, well, I did too. Well, I did too. Well, then at his funeral, he died in April of 2012, April 4th, 2012. Mm-hmm. At his funeral, my cousin and I were sitting in that little old country church that we grew up in. And we had a guest singer who was actually in my dad's gospel group, Mr. Joey Recker. He was going to perform the Old Rugged Cross. We're sitting right beside the piano and the hymnal is open. And every so often, the ceiling fan would turn a page in the hymnal that by the time Mr. Joey sat down to perform Old Rugged Cross, it was already on that page. And so he didn't have to turn the page at all. And he just sat down and played it. And so that song is my personal favorite gospel song, and just the history in my family makes it even more so, you know. I told you it's going to get out there.
What do you make of that? Like, are you a person that believes in destiny? Do you prefer not to dig too deep into the details? Are you like, because sometimes when there's things I can't explain, I'm like, I need to make peace with not knowing what this means. Do you have an explanation for, like,
I don't know.
Those pretty wild coincidences?
Yeah, it's hard to believe that they're coincidences, but I don't know anything.
Exactly.
And, you know, I don't know. None of us know anything, really. And so, we don't have any control, you know, over.
Yeah.
We didn't choose to be here, and we don't choose when we go for the most part. And so I don't know.
Well, that leads us to a really wonderful song on the album, When It's My Time, which you co-wrote with your wife, correct?
Mm-hmm.
When the two of you wrote it, did you know that it was going to be a part of this gospel project?
I didn't.
And, like, was it ultimately a challenge to kind of bring it together with these, like, other time-honored songs?
Well, the way it happened, so my son and I were in an accident in 2020.
Yeah.
And we got T-boned. I only broke my collarbone. Could have been a lot worse. And but after that accident, this song, When It's My Time, was sort of born. And my wife and I were just sitting out on the back porch, wrote it really quickly. Just something I wanted to say, you know, I have no control over when I go. I knew on this gospel album I wanted to include at least one original, which is the opposite right. from my other albums. Normally I'll do an album full of songs I wrote and one cover. And I was going to do this other gospel song that I wrote when I was 17 called Hold Me Closely that was my first cut as a songwriter. Also, a crazy mythical story. I'll tell you that later. And so
I'm putting a pin in it.
And so I sat down and me and Dave, the engineer, were getting mics set up or something. And I had just wrote that song, When It's My Time. And I was reciting the words. I was like, man, check this song out, you know. And he was like, that sounds like a gospel song. Maybe we should put it on this album. And so that's how that happened.
Okay. That's a beautiful story. I also do want to hear more of your mythic tales. But I wonder, you know, I love thinking about the process from, like, you're just writing a few songs or you're just, you know, coming up with a few arrangements and you're not totally sure what it's going to turn into, all the way to the end of the process where you're sharing the songs with the world, you're on tour, you're selling LPs, you know, the whole, like, business part of it. I feel like for anyone that considers themselves an artist, there's always some tension or at least interaction between the art side and the business side.
Art and commerce. Yeah.
The art and commerce part. And it's this record, I think, kind of heightens that because it's sacred in nature. It's deeply spiritual. It's about a really important spiritual moment in your life where you were reckoning with mortality. Like, there's so much spiritual weight to this record. Has that made you approach like the business side differently? Like, how does it feel to be now sharing that with the world and ramping up on tour and things like that?
It felt like I remember a couple weeks before we went in, I called my manager and just asked, like, man, we're about to spend a whole lot of money on making a gospel album. Is that, do you think, should we do that? You know, is that smart? And he was just like, man, you need to do what your heart's telling you to do. And so you're going to own it. You know, it's going to be on your record label. And if it's something you feel like you want to share with everybody, then you should do it. And so, I don't know. It just felt so natural. And perhaps maybe I should worry more about money, but I don't really. And I'm not loaded, but I'm keeping the lights on. You know, I'm not making a killing, but I am making a living. And so I just don't worry. Paycheck to paycheck. I should worry more, but I don't. And so it just really doesn't occur to me. I let the accountant worry about that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's good.
That's great. No, you have to do your job, which is doing the inspired stuff.
I feel like if it didn't work out and all of a sudden I wasn't making my living making music, I will go back to, you know, being a tree surgeon. I don't know. I'll do something else, you know.
You're a tree surgeon?
Well, that's what they called it. We would transplant, we would put pine trees. We would, you know, tree farmer. I don't really know what I'm doing. I can just run a chainsaw.
Wow. I feel like if knowing a lot about something makes you look at it differently, and people who know a lot about trees, I feel like you have to move through the world with like a deeper care and understanding, because you can like have a relationship with all these plants around you.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I'm just glad to be here on this rock and experiencing it all anyway. Tree surgeon or no tree surgeon.
I have a question about an interview you gave around the release of your last album, Keep 'Em on Their Toes, which is such a great record. My favorite track, if people are curious, is Brent's duet with Nikki Lane. You said about that album that it was a way to share yourself with your kids if you ever died and didn't get a chance to watch them grow up. That really struck me, especially because that was years before, you know, the car accident and this album, which really does feel like that legacy album. Do you always keep mortality front of mind? And like, is that part of how you think about your artistic process?
Always. Yeah, it's all I ever think about. I don't know a whole lot about anything, but I do know that this life is so temporary, and I can't even believe that I get to experience it at all. And I've always been that way. I was like 12 years old reminiscing the old days when I, you know, I was like, oh, yeah. I've just always sort of been that way and knew that it was all fleeting. And every moment of my life, it's, you know, sometimes it induces anxiety, and then other times it helps me to realize I have no control, so there's no need to worry. And that's how in each album since my daughter was born has been for that. And you know, like the first album is, this is where I'm from, this is where daddy's comes from, and then this is stories about all those characters, Providence Canyon, and then Keep 'Em on Their Toes was, this is what I think about, and then this album, the gospel album, is, this is what I believe in.
Wow. Do you tell them about that as you work on each album? Are they like, what do you think their sense is of your legacy?
I don't think they're thinking about it like that right now. But yeah, I have told them. Or there's a song on Keep 'Em on Their Toes album that is it's called Dust Under My Rug. And there's a line that goes, I feed my babies when they cry. And my daughter's always like, you do, daddy.
It's just like, you do. So,
yeah, if that's
you're doing something right. if that rings true.
Yeah, that's right.
How did you work on the track list for this gospel album? I just like trying to put myself in your shoes. You grew up in the church. You must have had like a treasure trove of songs all kind of competing to be on this record. How did you go about creating a record out of something that's like this enormous tradition?
I have said that these are just sort of the Southern gospel greatest hits. And so they're mm-hmm. just the ones that we would perform more often than others. And my dad leads the singing at the church now. And so I would ask him, you know, here's my list. What am I missing? And I would ask my sister as well. And so they kind of helped me pick the songs for the album.
That's great. I'm wondering how you're feeling about the reception of the album so far. We're in this really super connected world, and we're very globalized in some ways, you know, streaming, social media, Sirius XM, like all these, I could go on and on. And it really struck me as I was listening to your album that as much as it's something that anyone can relate to, and it's super relatable and universal in some ways, it's also hyper-regional, right, hyper-specific to a particular place and time and tradition. So are there things that you hope that someone, like, say someone in Egypt or, right, you know, Korea is listening to your album? Like, what do you want them to know about the Southern gospel tradition?
Well, that music is what is the reason why there is any music now. I mean, it's sort of like it's the most popular music in the world. It's influenced gospel music, Southern gospel music, you know, has influenced all of the world. And, you know, that's like the British invasion of the 60s. They were just, you know, playing back to us their interpretation of what came from that region, you know. And and so, you know, that was the whole point. You know, it's all soul, you know, it's Southern soul, gospel, country, rock. It's all from that, you know. So I think if you enjoy any of those genres of music, that's where it all came from. And that's what this album is.
Absolutely. And is there any particular draw as far as like, do you want to tour this album, especially in the South, because that's where the roots are? Or do you feel like there's something special about playing it all over the place?
I think it's better to play it. Once again, historically, like for whatever reason, the South, so much stuff comes from the South, good and bad. Mm-hmm. And what's crazy is the South doesn't recognize it when it's what created it. But until someone comes back and shows them, you know, like this is, you know, isn't the South the most American of America?
Yeah, that's so fascinating. A lot of times, like these traditions are like reinterpreted and brought back around, and it's on the back around that it makes the most sense to people.
It's wild. And so, but people outside of the South really appreciate it more so than the South itself. Yeah. And so, you know what I mean? And, you know, it's very, the South is obviously very diverse, and, totally. I don't know. It's just the most, for whatever reason, the South creates it all, but the rest of the world, they recognize it as it's happening, the good and the bad.
That's so true. I think that's a really interesting way to think about it. I also have been thinking about how for so many people, especially like if, you know, here in New York, people hear Southern gospel music, they think, oh, that's a Black tradition, right? Mm-hmm. And like you've credited Otis Redding, you've like been, you've been very upfront about like, you know, many of my influences are Black artists.
Yeah.
And we are in this moment where so many people are questioning, like, what are white people's relationship to Black culture? How can we make it better? How can we, you know, properly give credit where it's due? Do you feel like you have a role as a white artist to, like, share this Black tradition with the world? And, you know, even if you just want to share some of the Black artists that have inspired you that people could listen to if they love your music.
I think just because it hasn't been done, you know what I mean? I think just maybe because just people are just genuinely ignorant. They're not aware.
True.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so if nothing else, and just the idea of what I said a while ago about the South being so diverse and like, we all went to school together. We were all going to church together. We're all eating, working. We're all poor together. You know, we all were together. And so there is no, that's why the South comes out. That's why there's such great music and art that does come from the South, and food and everything, because it is so, you know, intertwined. And, you know, I don't know. And maybe I came from a different little pocket where I'm from, but we all got along too, you know? And, and I don't know. I love where I'm from, and I want the world to know that, yeah, it is like that. You know, I want people to know.
Yeah,
but
that's what you were raised on, and that's what influenced you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I come at this definitely from like a very lefty socialist tradition, but that's what actually gets me really fired up about country and folk and Americana music, that from the outside, and yes, there's truth to this. There is a lot of tension of, you know, making sure there's equal access to resources, et cetera.
Absolutely.
But I think there is also a tradition of like true class solidarity in country and Americana, of like working people have so more in common with each other than we realize. And that's the power of these simple songs that anyone can relate to. It's like, yes, we have a lot of reasons to have tension with each other, but more than that, we, like, if we're working people side by side, like, why let ourselves get divided?
and I think, you know, in my role in that too, is if just musically inspires someone to where they don't feel like I'm preaching at them, you know, like, and I don't mean the gospel stuff. I mean, all of the social issues as well. Like, maybe I think when someone discovers something themselves, or at least they think they have discovered something themselves, they're more apt to, you know, then act. And so it's just like when you discover great music, like music that you, none of your friends know about, and you and you feel like you discovered that. And so you go, oh, everybody has to listen to this, you know, and then you're the person that turned them on. I feel the same way with like social issues, that if you know, it's just like, it's in there, you know what I mean? But I think if people discover it, then it excites them, you know, to, you know, anyway.
Yeah, nobody wants to be like hit over the head with what they're supposed to do, but
sometimes
I think that is the role of
over the,
sometimes of course,
they gotta hit.
But it's like in the long term, often it's like culture workers who are really able to move things forward, because if there's a song that's undeniably catchy, it doesn't feel like you're learning a history lesson, but that's how you can like, that's how we change the world.
Totally.
Hopefully.
Yeah. And hopefully everybody
fingers crossed, that's how we change the world.
Everybody has a role and can work together, you know, on what that is. Yeah.
Are you somebody that is always writing, or do you kind of like to stay in one zone creatively and then close the book and then start the next chapter?
I'm always writing. And sometimes I won't know that I am, and I won't know that like all of these songs were for this one project until after I'm like not intentionally writing for a specific direction that I'm aware of, but my subconscious may be. And then when it's time to make the whatever that project is, then I go, oh, that's where all of these were coming from. So I just constantly write.
Interesting. Then it's in retrospect that you divide it up into, or like then you start to realize, oh, a project has been coming together, whether I knew it or not.
And it may be halfway through, and then I will write with that intention. But then there are sometimes that, and I remember when I first moved to Nashville in 2008, I was having trouble writing, and I was getting my first cut, which was that Hold Me Closely song, that other gospel song that I told you had another mythical story behind. Can we
hear the mythical story? I would love to hear the mythical story.
Here it goes. And then I'll lead into the what I was going to say about seasons.
Sorry.
Seasons of inspiration. Well, it's all one story though. So,
okay, great.
I wrote this, one of the first like real songs that I was like, whoa, where did that come from? It was when I was first discovering the Muse, and these songs just would feel like they fell out of the sky. And there was one of them that was called Hold Me Closely that I wrote in like 20 or 30 minutes. And it was sort of a gospel song, but I didn't know what it was about. It just fell out. And so 2 days later, my mama's mom passed away, my Nana. And I was like, whoa, that's where that song came from, I guess. And I performed it at her funeral. And then that after the funeral, everybody was going to come to my folks' house and eat and all that. And Before they got there, I laid down on the couch and fell asleep. And I had this dream. And in this dream, I woke up and everybody had shown up. And I walk into my parents' den and there's a, you know, our living room. And my Nana is sitting there on this stool and she's got this big white book with gold trim. And she leaned, and I say, Nana, what are you reading? And she leans it down and she says, a song book. And when she says that, I wake up from the dream and everybody's there that I had dreamed about. Well, I took that dream as though there are these songs that are already written and whatever, you know, in this universe somewhere else. And every now and again, one gets sent to me if I'm doing right. And so that song, Hold Me Closely, then became the first song I ever had recorded as a songwriter. It was my first cut as a songwriter by the Oak Ridge Boys. And it's a gospel song. Well, at that studio that day, I was having trouble writing songs and while they were recording. And Miss Jessie Coulter came in the studio and I was telling her, I said, Miss Jessie, I feel like I can't write anything worth anything right now. I don't know what's going on. I'm kind of hitting a roadblock. And she said, well, honey, right now you're living and you need to just live. And then the songs will come later. So that's what I try to do.
Oh, that is excellent advice. Damn. Wow. What a cool person to be getting casual songwriting advice from.
You're telling me.
I have a question for you that I have to ask, and you can and should plead the fifth if you don't want to answer. Mm-hmm. I am curious if psychedelics ever play a role in your creation process, because you seem so connected to your dream world. I call it the velvet world, where like it's the world of feelings and premonitions and those deep psychic connections. Okay, so yeah.
Well,
are we ever going to get like a true like psych rock album?
I don't know. I you know, I've always been that way. I think my family's kind of that way. Very, very rural and country people, but also just sort of very connected to the earth. And you know, I think about my grandpa would just sit there in a chair and stare out across the field. He didn't call it meditating, but that's what he was doing. You know, he just meditated.
Looking out on a vacant field.
Yeah. I mean, that's totally. And you know, the old schoolers, they didn't think that they were doing that, but that's exactly what they were doing. And I didn't really start, I didn't get into psychedelics until around 2017, and my preferred method is psilocybin, and I love the velvet world, but all it does is the way I describe it to people who have never had an experience is that it really just confirmed what I already knew, sort of, you know.
Yes.
I already knew it, and then I saw it with my own eyes, you know. I don't know that it's influenced my writing. It's weird. It doesn't matter what I do. If I go on a drinking binge, or if I get too stoned, or if I haven't had much sleep, or if I eat mushrooms, or whatever I do, it never really affects the way I write. You know, now I can't write while I'm tripping, but it doesn't. Yeah. Thank goodness, for whatever reason, it hasn't affected my ability to write songs. It's just kind of there.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like, if you're already kind of attuned to those subconscious feelings and the way that you're connected to the world and other people, it would make sense that isn't like a total reality shift for you.
Right.
Like tripping maybe is just connecting to a deeper part of yourself that you've always engaged with.
I wish everybody could experience it.
Yeah.
Man, if everybody just at some point of age, just you had to just trip a little bit, you know, like
a little bit,
just a little. You don't have to go over the rainbow. You can just get to the rainbow, you know, like I think it
just
would,
like a minor ego death or like an ego
just,
nap.
If everybody could experience it one time, it would solve a lot of things, I think.
That reminds me of the new Hayes Carl album, which I love so much. When on Nice Things, when he's like, this is why y'all are all strung out to Christmas.
Totally.
This is why I left you all them seeds.
God, man.
We've been given these gifts. Oh my gosh, I just caused my mic level to spike with my passion.
I saw Hayes last night. I love that dude so much. And
he's the best.
He's been one of my biggest influences over the years. I can't believe he talks to me, but he's brilliant, you know.
I can believe it. You're in the right company, it seems like.
I think so.
Do you read much poetry?
I did as a, you know, in high school. I read a lot of fiction now. I read a lot of sci-fi, but no, not a lot of poetry. I actually I've been trying to read more poetry, I discovered a haiku that I didn't know that was the most famous of haikus, and I won't be able to remember the author right now, but you probably know it. It's called...
We can put that in the show notes later.
But so my wife and I, when we're preparing my daughter's lunch to take to school, we've turned the napkins into works of art. And so we do a different message on her napkin every day. And so one of the ones that I did last week was this, it's this haiku called the Old Silent Pond, or the Old Pond. Mm-hmm. And it is, it's so good. It's by a Japanese poet. Oh, it's so good. But it's like, there was an old
by Matsuo Basho?
That's it. That's the one. There was a quiet pond. A frog jumps in. Splash.
that's perfect.
I don't think I recited it well, but so like I want to get back into reading more haikus mm-hmm. and just poem structure helps so much in songwriting mm-hmm. for me.
Oh, I think country music is traditional country music has so much in common with those like old English formal poetry traditions, like
for sure.
Having to write like sonnets and villanelles made me a better
it's so good
like pop
you.
Songwriter
it's,
I think
it's yeah it's input output and it's mm-hmm. it's so good yeah
and I it's working in restriction
yeah absolutely yeah I need to refresh my memory on what the definition and titles of all of these all of the
poetic types. I actually have some paperback books I can send you. I'll
love
mail them
that.
To you.
Thank you so much. Really. I'd need
of course.
That.
Of course. Okay. Are you ready to move into the silly lightning round finale of this interview?
I think so.
Okay. My rules for the lightning round are you can skip any question. Don't think about it too much. Just first thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
Okay. Who was your first celebrity crush?
Oh, I don't know. I skip. I don't even know. I don't know.
You're a man of the people. No celebrities for you. What is the most important food or beverage on your touring rider?
Water.
Well, yeah. What is one fact about Luke Bryan that the world needs to know?
He's a wonderful piano player.
Ooh, that's a good one. What is your favorite pasta shape?
Macaroni, like elbow macaroni.
Mm-hmm. Casket, cremation, launched into space, or other?
Oh, man. I think other. I don't know what.
What is your most useful non-musical skill?
I'm a good hugger.
And finally, what is your favorite children's book?
Ooh, probably The Giving Tree.
Oh, that is a good one.
But did you see the new rendition somebody did where they sort of changed the story of The Giving Tree?
Does the tree finally get a little more assertive? Because that's what I've been wanting all these years.
It is that. You should look it up because I'm not going to be able to quote it correctly. But it is so much more satisfying.
Oh, great. Brent Cobb, you have been such a cool, fascinating guest. The new gospel album is fantastic, and it's out now. Everyone, please go get this album. It's so great. Thank you for talking with me.
Thank you very much for listening. Thanks for letting me talk. And maybe we'll meet in person one of these days.
Please. I'll put some things in the mail, and then we'll move it to IRL.
Thank you so much.
Basic Folk This Week was produced by me, Cindy. Our music composed by Alex Stanton. Basic Folk is available wherever you get podcasts. You can also search on the SiriusXM app for Basic Folk. You can find us at thebluegrasssituation.com and at our website, basicfolk.com. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Oh man, you listened to the whole episode? Wow, you are really something. Okay, bye.